SoundCloud. So please tune back in. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Outside the Studio. As always, I'm your host, Matthew Blitner. And in case you didn't catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page Tamari, you can visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full works. And now, for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports takes. And it's really not a good time to be a sports fan if you think about it. Over in Major League Baseball, you have the league, run by the owners, and the Players Association, obviously representing the players, throwing verbal grenades at each other through private meetings, through the media, through all different platforms. Over in the NFL, you have multiple different scandals going on. In the NHL, you are going into the All-Star break tonight, which should be a good thing, but as a study just showed, a study that just came out today and published by The Athletic shows millennials and Gen Z don't care about the NHL, so that's a problem. And the NBA, well, at least the NBA can escape from this, although if you're a fan of the two New York teams in terms of the Brooklyn Nets and the New York Knicks, well, the Knicks have pretty much fallen out of contention. I know they're still, you know, a half game out of the play-in round, but all that goodwill from last year is gone. The Nets have lost six in a row. Is there any positives in sports right now? I mean, there's a lot to talk about, thankfully, but it makes you scratch your head a little bit about what's going on. So, knowing that, a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk with the YES Networks and CBS's Ian Eagle about what's going on in the NFL, as well as with the Brooklyn Nets. We're going to talk with Jason Stark of The Athletic about some of the issues in Major League Baseball. And, of course, we'll throw in some hockey in between the two. Right now, though, let's talk about the big news over in the NFL. The Brian Flores scandal that seems to be hitting just on all fronts. Brian Flores, the now former head coach of the Miami Dolphins, is suing the National Football League, the Miami Dolphins, the New York Giants, and the Denver Broncos for racial discrimination, among other things, named in a 58 or 59 page lawsuit. And it's not necessarily important that it's 58 or 59 pages. Most lawsuits are very lengthy, so that's not too out of the ordinary. However, he's alleging that the Dolphins fired him for racial discrimination purposes and that their owner tried to pay him $100,000 for every loss by tanking in the 2019 season. In other words, the owner, Stephen John wanted to have Brian Flores throw the games because he wanted to get a higher draft pick. He didn't want to have the presumed pick that Brian Flores wanted, which was Joe Burrow. He wanted Tua Viola. And I'm sorry, Tua, if you're out there. I know I just probably butchered your last name. But the owner wanted Tua. The head coach wanted Burrow. We saw how that turned out. The Dolphins got Tua. Burrow is now going to the big game with Cincinnati in, 9 days' time? So clearly a misstep there. Whether there's actual proof or not that the owner tried to pay Flores $100,000 for every loss that he would have, well, that's going to come about in discovery if it gets that far in the lawsuit. The Giants portion of it, Flores is alleging that the Giants brought him in under false pretenses, saying that they had already made up their mind to hire Brian Daboll from the Bills to be their new head coach, and brought Flores in 3 days later for a farce interview, strictly to adhere to the Rooney Rule, saying that they have to interview X number of minority candidates before they can make an actual hire. His proof, so to speak, on that is that Bill Belichick, texted him saying that, you know, congrats, he heard that he was getting the job from the Giants. And then Belichick texts later on saying, oh, my mistake. Well, he used more colorful language, obviously, of which we cannot use on the airwaves. And Belichick saying, oh, you know, I messed that up. They're actually going with Dable. And yet they still brought in, the Giants still brought in Flores for an interview. The Giants, of course, deny the allegation as any team would. Did you really expect the team to come out and be like, you know what? Yes, we admit we're wrong, we're guilty. It's not going to happen. Why would any team, why would any owner ever come out and say, you know what? Yes, exactly what we're being accused of doing. Yes, we did this. It just wouldn't happen. And the Broncos portion of this, Flores is alleging that John Elway did not take the interview seriously by coming to the interview drunk and or hungover. We have heard a statement from Elway and the Broncos saying that that was clearly not the case. They had just came back from a long trip, and they so wanted to meet with Flores that he didn't even take any time to rest and immediately came to the interview disheveled because that's how much they wanted to meet with him. Again, it's going to be very hard to prove that Elway was either drunk or hungover or something. Unless Flores somehow took a secret blood alcohol test, a secret sobriety test on Elway, which we know he didn't do, there's next to no chance that he has any proof of that. And the NFL obviously is being sued because they're part of the whole grander scheme of things in the racial discrimination aspect of this. We've heard over with the Browns that there's now allegations that they tried to buy off their former head coach to tank. We've heard that a number of general managers and players have come out in, you know, saying that, you know, well, maybe, possibly, there might be some proof of some of this. The facts of the matter are there is one minority head coach out of 32 teams in the NFL. That's Mike Tomlin with the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Rooney Rule was implemented to try to get more minorities represented in the head coaching and executive ranks. There are, I believe, 8 minority general managers out of the 32, and there's just the one head coach. I believe when the rule was instituted, there were 3 minority head coaches in the NFL. So clearly a step back if you think about it. Whether there is a direct line of racial injustice, it's possible. You know, the owners are not the most scrupulous of people in the NFL. We've seen that. Obviously, that leads to another scandal with Dan Snyder over with the now Washington Commanders. That's a whole other story. And they've seen that the owners might have a bit of an issue having a minority be the face of the franchise. Let's face it, ownership is not the face of the franchise. We rarely hear from the owners. General managers in football, unlike in other sports, are not generally heard from. So they're not the faces of their team. The head coach is the face of the team in the NFL. It's that simple. And for there to only be one minority head coach, it raises a legitimate question over the motives behind that and the reasons behind it. We will see where this lawsuit goes. It is way, way too early to throw, you know, guilty verdicts around and say, well, you know, the owners are guilty of this, or, oh, no, the owners are innocent of this. Let's get beyond the filing of the lawsuit. Let's get to discovery. Let's get to the inside of a courtroom. And then we'll make our determination of whether or not what parts of this lawsuit have merit and what do not. I'm not saying that the lawsuit does not have merit. I am not the NFL and the team saying these are baseless claims. So I'm not saying that. Okay, I think there is some merit to some of these claims. Do I think the entire lawsuit, everything named in it, is 100% accurate? Probably not, just because it's going to be very difficult to prove a lot of things. Again, the John Elway thing is going to be next to impossible to prove. Could there be some truth to some of the allegations? Absolutely. In any case, in any story, there's 3 sides. And it's the old adage. There's side A, side B, and then the truth is generally somewhere in the middle. That's what going on here. The truth of what's going on is probably somewhere in the middle between what Flores is alleging and what the teams in the NFL are saying. So it's going to be something to bear watching. And you know what? I give him credit. I give him all the credit in the world. He is throwing his career down the toilet to stand up for what he believes in. Because no team is going to hire him. Then no team is going to come near him with a 10-foot pole as long as this lawsuit is active. So, do I think he belongs in the NFL as a head coach? Absolutely. You can see he's got an excellent mind to be a head coach in the NFL. So, it begs the question, would he really risk everything if he had no proof of anything? No, he's a smart man. He's not going to throw away everything he's worked for since he was probably 5 years old to all of a sudden throw it all away on a wing and a prayer. He's not going to do it. He's not stupid. So we're going to figure out exactly what's going on in that. We're going to have something happen. We're going to follow along with everything as that story continues to unfold. Right now, we're going to hear from our first guest of the show, and that is a recorded interview with the Yes Network's and CBS's Ian Eagle, as he's going to talk about the Nets losing, about the Brian Flores situation, about the big game coming up. We're going to hear all of that from him in just a moment. So let's get Ian Eagle's interview loaded.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to Outside the Studio. I'm joined now by our guest, Ian Eagle of the Yes Network and CBS Sports. Ian, it's Matt Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
Hey, what's up, Matt? Good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us here, Ian. And as I understand it, the Nets are playing tonight against the Utah Jazz, and they're on a six-game losing streak. What do you make of what this team is going through at the moment?
Yeah, it's been very disjointed. I think the fact that they haven't had a consistent rotation, consistent lineups, has finally caught up to them. When Kevin Durant was in the lineup, they could make up and camouflage some of their issues because they could just lean on him. And not only have they missed their offense with Kevin Durant out, they've missed his defense. And that goes a little bit under the radar, how much of a factor he is defensively when they switch and how comfortable they are with him guarding a variety of different players, and him as a help defender because of his length, because of his basketball IQ, the fact that he can anticipate things, that creates opportunities for the rest of the team. So right now, it is definitely a low point for the team. The James Harden, Kyrie Irving combination is not translating into victories on the road. And the concern really has more to do with when Durant's going to be back, if Joe Harris is going to be back, and if he is, when will he be back, and at what percentage will he be? Is he going to be 100%? Is he going to be 75%? Are there more concerns about that ankle? Are they going to have to look into further surgery down the road? These are all legitimate questions that they're facing. But to evaluate this team, it's a little tough until you see the big three together. And if this team can try to put together a 15, 20, 25-game stretch to really see what they're all about before the playoffs actually begin.
It's interesting that you note how important Durant's defense is to the team. A lot of people, as you mentioned, they overlook his defense. Durant obviously is known as a prolific scorer, but his defense is, of course, a missed component for this team. And the big three, if you put it, they haven't gotten a chance to play together so much since Harden was acquired. I mean, it's either Harden's out with an injury, Durant's out with an injury, Kyrie's out for a variety of different factors over the last couple of years. Is it safe to say that the big three experiment did not pan out?
Well, it's not safe to say it yet. I think they're going to let this play out and see what it all looks like when the smoke clears at the end of this season. They're 13-3 when those three players have been in the lineup together. That's regular season and playoffs. They feel good about what they can achieve when they have all three available. But based on the current vaccination status of Kyrie Irving, the mandate in New York, we know that Kyrie cannot participate in home games. As of right now, in Brooklyn based on the knee injury to Kevin Durant. He's not a part of it. Joe Harris is the fourth highest paid player on the team. Very important to this squad. They've been missing his presence from the perimeter. It changes everything in terms of their spacing. And a lot of those drives from James Harden, where he's missing floaters on the inside, those would be drives to the rim, kick out to Harris, open look at a three, and you're talking about one of the most prolific three-point shooters in the NBA. So the grade right now would be incomplete, and it's hard to say that this thing hasn't worked until there's another full season to make a true evaluation. They played just over 50 games in this season, and they're going to be judged on what they do in the playoffs, Matt. It's as simple as that.
That's very accurate, and it almost sounded for a moment like you were actually giving us the play-by-play there with Harden getting the ball out to Harris. And with the trade deadline literally right around the corner at this point, do you see a situation in which Kyrie or Harden are no longer part of this team's post-deadline?
Personally, I don't. Now, if someone within upper management, Sean Marks, ownership, Joe Tsai, Clara Wu Tsai, if they've determined that this situation is untenable, and they're obviously privy to things behind the scenes that I am not and you are not, that would have to be a gut feeling that they don't believe that they can win with this current group. I don't think it's at that level. I think they want to see this thing through and then make some decisions at the end of the season. If it doesn't translate into a championship, then there very well could be some major changes. James Harden and the Nets did not agree on a new contract. He would be a free agent. There could be a sign-and-trade. There could be Harden just making the decision to move on and leave. You know, I think the frustration from Harden is based on the fact that he came to the Nets with the idea that he would be a part of this big three and that some of the pressure would be taken off his shoulders in trying to win a championship. And what we've seen is a lot of what we saw in Houston, where he's being asked to do a lot. And unfortunately, you know, I'm not seeing a lot of the ball movement that we thought we would see with the big three in there. I'm not seeing a lot of the fluid offense. I'm seeing a lot of James Harden dribbling the ball, waiting, shot clock down to five, and now try to make something happen, and it just has not been very smooth.
So since you believe, and I think that you would have to be right on this, that they're not going to break up the team, they're not going to break up the big three right now, who do you see them potentially going out and getting to either, A, lighten the load on Harden, or to be just, you know, add that complementary piece that can solidify them down the stretch and into the playoffs?
Well, they need shooting. That to me has been very obvious, that they do not have the proper spacing on the floor that they envisioned when this season started. Kyrie only playing in road games, that certainly plays a role in it, trying to find a rhythm, trying to create some chemistry, and now you're back to square one on these home games. Without Kevin Durant, that also has been very obvious, that they just don't have another guy that they can lean on. Patty Mills has been asked to do a lot. I don't think they ever visualized that Patty Mills would have as large a role as he has had this season. He was supposed to be part of that bench mob, leading the second unit. Instead, he's been basically a starter every single game, and he's getting a lot of shots because that's the way the team is set up. And he's made a bunch of shots, but I don't think at this stage of his career the Nets expected Patty Mills to be their 1A or 1B scorer. So shooting would probably be what the team is focused on. Yeah, if you're looking for a name, maybe someone like Terrence Ross, someone of that ilk, someone that you can lean on at times to take over some scoring responsibilities when Kyrie Irving is not in there or when James Harden is in there, but you're asking him to move the ball more and trust some of his teammates to make things happen. Bruce Brown, DeAndre Bembry, they're good role players, but they're a little bit redundant on this team. They need perimeter presence.
Excellent analysis, Ian, and we thank you for bringing that to us so far. We want to shift gears right now to the big story, obviously, that everyone is talking about over in the NFL. You get to call a lot of NFL games over at CBS. No one better. But is this a turning point in the league in that this seems to always be something that's festering under the surface about the race issue in the NFL? Of course, the Rooney Rule was implemented way back because of this, and now we're starting to see it come to a head. What's your take on the Brian Flores situation?
Well, you know, Matt, obviously I've done these games for 20-plus years, so I've been around head coaches and I've been around decision-makers in the NFL, and I only know what I'm allowed to know. You can ask questions, you can poke around, you can try to understand the inner workings, but unless you're in those rooms, unless you're actually hearing from the owner of a team, the GM of the team, as to what went into the hiring of a certain person, you don't really know. You speculate and you draw conclusions, but you don't really know. The hope is always that the person getting the job is the best person for the job. And it doesn't matter based on what they are, what they look like, who they are, what their background is, that they impressed their new boss, that they would be the right person to best represent the team. And that's the other part of it as well. I think what's happened in the NFL, and somewhat in the NBA, but in the NFL maybe even more so, you are the true spokesman for the team. You are the face of the franchise in many ways. You're doing multiple press conferences a week. You're being asked questions about strategy, of course, but then personnel and other aspects of the team. And you don't really hear much from GMs over the course of a season in the NFL. It's the coach. It's the coach right after the game. It's the coach the day after the game, and then later in the week after practice, and then prior to the game. It's the coach. So owners and GMs are not just putting the trust in that person to run the team, but also to be the face of the team. So I am concerned that there hasn't been progress, and the fact that maybe this quote-unquote dirty little secret that NFL people have been very small-minded in their approach has finally been left for people to understand and realize that it's a real thing. Brian Flores has certainly jeopardized his career. Maybe he gets a job, and maybe the Houston Texans hire him and they don't care about the lawsuit and they respect him even more so for being direct and trying to unearth the truth in this situation. Or maybe the NFL avoids any further actions, but it's an embarrassing note that they have to deal with. Either way, the fact that it's been put out in the open means that we're going to have hopefully more constructive conversations about this, and the hope is it will result in some kind of change moving forward in the NFL hiring practices.
Well said, and you know, I'd have to think that with Flores willing to put his career on the line, he's got to have some. And beyond just the Bill Belichick text messages, he's got to have some concrete proof because he's a smart guy. He's not going to throw away his livelihood over absolutely just a whim and a prayer. He's going to take the step because he knows he has something that can turn the table. It's only just going to be seeing what that is. In regards to, though, this week coming up, this is the big week for the NFL, so a lot of eyes are on the product. The big game is coming up in a little over a week's time. What's your take on the two teams in here, the Bengals and the Rams, having to go at it head-to-head in California?
Yeah, two tremendous stories and very different in their approaches to get to this big game. Cincinnati, there's this sense of destiny and this young group that has come together and quickly form the chemistry to lead to this kind of run, the belief in their young quarterback, Joe Burrow, following his lead, the presence he provides, the confidence that he permeates throughout that locker room. And then the Rams, who mortgaged their future in order to win now and to get it done now. Matthew Stafford, the deal that they made, multiple picks going to Detroit along with Jared Goff. Von Miller, the deal that they made with Denver, paying Odell Beckham to ensure that they had another weapon once they were dealing with injuries. This is a win-now mentality that some people would probably toss to the side and say, this is not the way you do it. You don't just focus on today. You've got to keep 2 years from now in mind and 4 years from now in mind. And the Rams have said, no, this is the window of opportunity for this group. So the fact that this turned into the collision course that we didn't expect, the Bengals and the Rams, is pretty incredible. And the reminder that in the NFL, if you do things the right way, you can go worst to first. They were the worst team in the division, Cincinnati. The worst. Now they're AFC North champions. They're AFC champions, and they have a chance to become Super Bowl champions. And this story has really been fun to follow. I've called a bunch of their games this season. Burrow is an impressive guy. He's unflappable. He's unfazed. That, to me, will be the question that will be answered. If this is a tight game in the fourth quarter and Cincinnati has a chance to win it with Joe Burrow, validating our belief that this guy can handle the pressure and the stage, and then flip it to Matthew Stafford, those kinds of questions are still out there. Stafford has always been physically gifted. He tried to lift the Lions out of the doldrums, couldn't quite do it. Goes to the Rams early in the season. It looked like the perfect marriage, McVay and Stafford. Then they went through their dips during the year, and you thought, maybe it just isn't constructed in the right way. They got hot at the right time. They've obviously gotten it done here in the postseason, and here they are. They nearly blew it against Tampa Bay. It was very close to being another heartbreaking loss. And now, how will Stafford handle it when he gets to the fourth quarter? If it's a tight game, does he make the big throw, or is it another one of those inexplicable interceptions? That's what's piquing my curiosity for next Sunday.
As you rightly pointed out, it's all eyes on the quarterback this coming Sunday. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Ian Eagle. Ian, before we let you go, I didn't want to necessarily put you on the spot, but with the big game right around the corner, who do you think is going to pull off the victory and hoist the Lombardi Trophy?
Yeah, my concern with Cincinnati would be that L.A. front. It is a legitimate weakness for the Bengals up front. That right side of the line has been victimized at times, not just in the postseason, but throughout the regular season. That combination at right guard, Adeniyi and Carmen, and then Prince at right tackle. Will that hold up against a ferocious front of L.A.? If this game plays out like the Kansas City game played out and they're down big again, 21-3, I don't know if it's in them to do it again, to come back again. But if this game is played more like the Tennessee game, where it's nip and tuck and we get into the fourth quarter, then I think the Bengals win the game. I like the Bengals in that pressure situation a little bit more than I like the Rams. So I'm kind of going with the fate storyline, and Cincinnati figures out a way to do it. I would not be surprised if the Rams win. But if the Rams win, I don't think they win a tight one. I think they win rather convincingly. If this is a close game, I think the Cincinnati Bengals are going to be Super Bowl champions.
Well, and isn't that something that people have longed to hear? Ian, we thank you so much for joining us here on Outside the Studio today. Best to you, best to your family. And we hope you enjoy not only the rest of the NFL playoffs, but the NBA season. And we look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Yeah, you got it, Matt. Great talking to you. We'll do it again.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was the excellent analysis from one of the top sports broadcasters in the country, in Ian Eagle. And we look forward to, again, chatting with him in the future. We'll see if he ends up being right in regards to who's going to win next Sunday. Not this Sunday, 2 days from now, but next Sunday. Right now, though, as we mentioned at the top of the show, it's not a great time for baseball. Along with the other sports, it's not a great time for baseball. you have the Players Association and the owners throwing verbal barbs at each other every which way, and it's looking very, very likely now. In fact, it's almost guaranteed that spring training will not start on time. There's next to no chance that spring training, outside of a miracle of miracles, that spring training starts on time. It's just not going to happen. The players, or the pitchers and catchers, are supposed to report, in a week and a half from now? They don't even have a deal. And Major League Baseball is not willing to negotiate in good faith. You can see it in the way they're handling everything. Major League Baseball wants to bring in a federal mediator, just like they did in 94. It was a disaster in 94. The Players Association rightly declined it. They just made the announcement earlier today that they've declined the request to bring in a federal mediator. You know why? Because the federal mediator, it's a voluntary thing. They're part of the process, as Major League Baseball likes to call it. Nothing's binding, and it didn't work almost 30 years ago. Why is it going to work now? It's not going to. So that's the problem. Major League Baseball is not willing to negotiate properly even. They keep saying, oh, well, we're going to have this, and we don't want to discuss this topic. We're not willing to budge on this topic. We're not willing to talk about that. And some of those topics are the ones that need to be changed in the game. Arbitration process, free agency, how to split up the money, the rules of the game, the way the game's played. Major League Baseball keeps saying, well, these are untouchable topics. If those are untouchable topics, what are we doing? The Players Association is going to be like, well, you know what? Screw it. We're not going to continue to, we don't want to give in. You guys aren't willing to negotiate. We're at least willing to talk a little bit. And it just becomes an entire mess of an issue. So that is something to keep an eye out on. Maybe they can somehow get things going and the season can only be delayed by, 2 weeks, and maybe they start mid-April. That's looking optimistic at this point. It really is. You need to have good faith on both sides. As my parents have always liked to tell me ever since I was little, a good compromise is one in which neither side is completely happy. So if that's the case, Major League Baseball needs to realize that they have to give a little, and the Players Association has to realize they have to give a little. If neither side wants to give, well, that's when you end up losing an entire season like the NHL did in the 04-05 season when they had a lockout. We don't want that. Major League Baseball is not in a place in this world where they can afford to get through an entire year without baseball. Fans, as a lot of outlets have said, fans will go somewhere else. This is not 1994 anymore, or the 1980s decade, when fans didn't have alternatives that were as popular. The NFL wasn't as popular back then. The NBA wasn't as popular back then. The NHL was, it was a small piece of the pie. College sports weren't as big back then. Guess what? All those things, soccer wasn't as big back then. And now, all those things are. Now, all those things have taken a much bigger piece of the pie, and Major League Baseball will not be able to get them back. It's really that clear. They will not be able to get the fans back. You saw it in 1994. The fans deserted Toronto. It took them two decades for the Blue Jays to all of a sudden have a large contingent of fans back. We saw fans drop attendance across the board coming back. It was only once the steroid home run race came into being in 1998 that fans started to come back to the sport. And then once the secret of the steroids was revealed, a lot of fans deserted again. And thankfully, we've moved past the height of the steroid era right now, even though we seem to be dealing with that every winter in the Hall of Fame discussion based upon what players we think may have been guilty or what players we think were doing something even though there's no proof. And we're going to talk about that very issue with our next guest, Jason Stott, in about a minute or two, as he's going to recap with us exactly what happened with the Baseball Hall of Fame induction vote for the class of 2022. We're going to talk about the lockout, where it currently stands, and we're going to get some fun things going from Jason, who, if you don't read his stuff already on The Athletic, it's been quite a while since he was with the Philadelphia Inquirer, then you are missing out if you haven't been reading it. He digs up these interesting factoids that any fan will easily love in his Strange But True columns. So why don't we go ahead and bring in Jason right now? So let's get this recorded interview locked and loaded and ready to go in a moment's time. And that way we can hear from one of the foremost experts who, by the way, if you didn't know, he himself is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. So let's get to it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined now by a Hall of Fame baseball writer from The Athletic, Jason Stark. Jason, it's Matt at Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
Matt, I am doing great, man. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us, Jason. We know last week the MLB Hall, the Baseball Hall of Fame finally announced who the class of 2022 is going to consist of. It's just David Ortiz. I shouldn't say just, but it is just the one player. What is your thoughts on the fact that it almost seems like that forbidden steroid door is being cracked open? Not to say that Ortiz necessarily tested positive. It's an inconclusive test, so I'm not going to point fingers one way or the other. But it seems like there's a mellowing towards the guys who were suspected of steroid use.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure about that, Matt, and I'm not sure that David Ortiz tells us that. And one of the reasons that I think that is that, you know, I wrote a piece right after the results were in that was entitled Five Things We Learned from the Hall of Fame Voting. And in that piece, I took a look inside the voting for David Ortiz. And it was really interesting. Did you know that almost two-thirds of voters who didn't vote for any of Bonds or Clemens or Manny Ramirez still voted for David Ortiz? And to me, like, those are your hardcore anti-PED voters, right? And the fact that they didn't vote for any of those guys but did vote for Ortiz in such large numbers tells you that they think there is a distinction between the circumstances that would indicate he should be considered a quote-unquote PED guy versus what we're looking at with some of these other players.
Well, and I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying on that, but we know that Ortiz has the, I'll call it the inconclusive test, because while he supposedly tested positive, it was obviously not up to standards of how testing is nowadays, so we'll call the inconclusive test. Bonds and Clemens never tested positive. Obviously, there's the, you know, the whole Balco scandal that happened. There was the list that came out. There was the investigation. But there was never a positive test. So why do the two of them get such hate and so much going against them when you could argue that David Ortiz was linked more conclusively than they were?
Well, let me point out that, I mean, it might seem like they get a lot of hate from the voters, and yet Barry Bonds missed getting elected by 36 votes. Roger Clemens missed getting elected by 39 votes. Think about that. Like, if you got 66% of the vote in the election for dog catcher, you know what people would say? They'd say, that's a landslide. If you get 66% in a Hall of Fame election, they say, sorry, man, not good enough. 75% is really hard to get. It's hard to get 75% of your friends to agree on where to go to lunch, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think that's a big part of this. But you raise a great point. Quite a few years ago now, this is 2015, I actually asked Rob Manfred to give us some guidance on how we should handle members of the PED era. And he said he would draw a big distinction between players who are proven to do something versus people where we're just speculating they did something or other. And so when I asked him, well, is there proof on Bronson Clemens? He didn't want to answer. He didn't want to get specific on that. And this is really the point you're making. They never tested positive. They never were suspended. They never failed a test, right? There was no the evidence exists to the point where the feds tried their best to implicate them, took both of them to court for offenses that were, they thought would at least prove that they did it. And both of them got off. They couldn't convict either of them. So it's not a real good standard of quote-unquote proof. I totally agree with you. I just think that the 2003 survey testing was too flimsy, obviously, for a lot of voters. The fact that the commissioner weighed in specifically on that in Ortiz's case and said there were a lot of questions about whether some of the positive tests were actually for banned substances, and specifically said we should not use those results as a reason not to vote for David Ortiz. Like, there's no doubt that that swayed a lot of voters.
Well, then let me ask you this. We're going to lump everyone together, whether they tested positive or they just have suspicion around them. Anyone who there's even a hint of steroids. Why is it? We know throughout history, baseball's not filled with wire boys, okay? That's the old line. Baseball's most certainly not filled with wire boys. You've had cheating of various different types. You had, you know, spitball. You had the scuffing of the ball. You had guys doing things to their bats to get an advantage. You had guys who were intentionally targeting other players on the team, you know, with their spikes, trying to intentionally injure them. Baseball is by no means, you know, the Boy Scouts. So if this is just modern-day version of all that, then why do we draw such a hard line against this form of cheating versus everything that's gone on in 100 years previous?
Yeah, well, that's a tremendous point. I just wrote about this, too. I posed the question, what kind of Hall of Fame do we want to have? Because if you want a hall of purity, then don't you have to go in and start throwing people out? You know, like Gaylord Perry and every ball scuffer and bat corker and all kinds of players in the Hall of Fame said stuff, did stuff that if we looked at it now, I don't know if it would pass the character and integrity test. But I don't see any movement to throw anybody out. So if we're not going to have that, the Hall of Purity, then do we just want to have a hall, much like the NFL Hall of Fame, that's just based on achievement and what players do on the field? I've voted for a long time, and we're, as voters, trying to handle this, we're faced with a bunch of choices, and they're all impossible. So I've been saying this for quite a while now. I would much rather vote on the best players, especially from the time before testing, and just elect the best players from that era to the Hall of Fame, and then let the people in Cooperstown try to figure out what to do with it. Because, you know, we've been trying. We're not any good at it. We're not. So if they want to put on Barry Bonds' plaque, hit more home runs than anyone who ever lived, but, and they can figure out what the but is, go for it. Explain it. Do what you need to do, but don't make us try to be the judges in a case where you don't even give us all the facts.
It's a great point you make right there about having not all the facts and still being asked to make the decision. And obviously it's a well-earned honor to be able to vote for the Hall of Fame. Among the other things that you do, obviously the Hall of Fame only comes around once a year. You also have, along with many other Toms, you have this thing called the Strange But True column on The Athletic, which, by the way, if you are out there listening, I highly suggest you read it, because it is, it's not just informative, but there's also a good amount of humor in there as if you are a baseball fan of any sort. So, Jason, what was the driving force behind you starting this, and what has been the strangest but truest thing that you've found to write about?
You know, Matt, I don't know how I became that guy that was going to become the collector of all the oddities, all the crazy stuff that happens in baseball every single day. I've always been drawn to that sort of thing. You know, I've always had fun looking for that sort of thing. You know, I grew up in Philadelphia reading a bunch of great sports writers who, like, always found humor and found people who were funny to help make all the readers laugh. And I've always thought, you know, I'd like to do that too. But then this thing, this column just sort of happened. You know, when I was working at the Philadelphia Inquirer, I used to do a little variation of it. And then when I went to ESPN, I kept doing different permutations of it. And since I've been at The Athletic, I've been doing, at the end of every year, the Strange But True Feats of the Year. This year, because there was a lockout, we actually divided up into three columns. But I've been doing this for quite a while now. And I think the strangest but truest one ever was, Benji Molina was playing for the Giants. So this must have been, 2012, right? And he hit a home run, but he didn't score a run on his own homer. So, like, I'm sure you're thinking, like, all right, how did this happen? How did the guy manage to...
I remember the instance in question.
Okay. Here's the deal. Benji Molina, slowest man ever to play baseball, right? So he hits a ball.
Because I might have him beat in the slow department.
Well, I'll have to get you guys racing sometime. So he hits a ball off the top of the wall at AT&T Park, and it gets ruled a single, bounces back onto the field. And so he's Benji Molina. Even though it hit the top of the wall, he stops at first base. So Bruce Bochy sends out a pinch runner. And while the pinch runner's running out there and Benji Molina's running toward the dugout, Omar Vizquel's on that team, and he says to Bruce Bochy, "Hey, I heard that ball hit the tin on top of the wall, which means that ball's a home run. It's not a that ball didn't hit the wall and bounce back. That went out of the park and bounced back." So Bruce Bochy goes out, asks the umpires to take a look at it, umpires look at the replay, and they agree. Home run. So they start signaling. Benji Molina starts to head to the top step to run back out and finish his home run try. And the umpire in first starts waving his hand saying, "No, no, no, you're already out of the game." So the pinch runner finished the trot on a home run that he didn't hit. And Benji Molina didn't score a run on his own homer. And this play is so screwed up that if you try to find it in Baseball Reference, you'll see that their computers still can't figure out how this happened.
Look, I remember watching the play live. I still can't figure out how it happened. And I consider myself somewhat of a baseball savant, having studied and read about and watched and played the game since I was 3 years old. So I still have no idea how that happened.
Yeah, well, these are the kind of players that keep me in business, man.
Absolutely. And look, strange but true type columns in any sport are what should help fans become even more of a fan than what they already are. I came into this business helping a guy who was doing strange but true in hockey. And if you want to talk about some real whack-to-do stories that happen, we can talk off the air about that, because we're limited to time here. But in regards to the upcoming season, which hopefully we get, we know the sides are talking right now. What do you when do you think the season might get started? And what is the oddest thing that you can think of that you want to see happen?
You know, I don't know if I am smart enough to guess the date that they make a deal, the date that the season starts. I would like to still think that the season can start on time. Obviously, spring training at this point looks like it's not going to start on time. But if you really take a step back and look at all the issues, like, I think you can see where the deal can be made, where it's going to be made. They both agree on that there should be universal DH. They both agree there should be expanded playoffs, haven't agreed on the number of teams, but agree on the concept. Both of agree there should be some kind of draft lottery to address tanking or whatever MLB wants to call it. They've agreed they should increase the minimum salary. They've agreed to eliminate draft pick penalties for free agents. They both agree they're open to the changing of that Super 2 arbitration system in some way. They've both made proposals for trying to address the Chris Bryant service time thing. And they're way apart on luxury tax, what should happen with that, way apart on, you know, the players wanting owners to eliminate revenue sharing. Like, those are huge obstacles, and there are massive differences on all these issues that I just outlined for you. But I at some point, when they start having real dialogue instead of talking at each other, you can see where there's a path to a middle ground on almost every issue. But right now, they're not having functional bargaining. And so we're still a long way away from a deal. But it doesn't make sense to me that the season wouldn't start on time. So let's go with that. And then, you know, my biggest frustration, I think, is there's such an opportunity here to come out of these labor talks with some rule changes that make the game more watchable, more entertaining. And, like, nobody really cares about the economics. Do you care, Matt?
It costs a lot of money to go to a game for a fan. Reporters get in for free, and that's about the only economics that really matter.
Right, that's not going to change, no matter what this deal looks like. That part won't change. But if they could come away saying, hey, we did all this, but we also have a pitch clock or something like it, like, now you're talking to your fan base and giving them a reason to not care that you just spent all this time trying to work out the old millionaire versus billionaire economics. You've given them something that makes the experience of watching a game better for them. Like, that, if that doesn't happen, this will have been the all-time wasted opportunity.
I couldn't agree with you more. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with The Athletic, Jason Stark. Jason, before we let you go, we want to get a fun hypothetical to you right here. It only seems natural. You're in the Hall of Fame. There are a lot of players in the Hall of Fame, a lot of players who, unfortunately, have not made the Hall of Fame. You get to pick any player to have ever suited up in a Major League Baseball game, past or present, living or dead, does not matter. You get to face them with the World Series on the line. Who do you want to face? You can either be the pitcher in the scenario where you've got to strike out the batter, or you can be the batter and you want to hit a home run off of whatever pitcher. The ball is literally in your glove right now. You make the decision.
Well, this is literally a laughable concept. Any pitcher or any hitter would be frightened in any way to face me. But we're going to put that whole part of the concept aside. We're going to assume that I could walk onto the field and actually have a chance not to look completely overmatched. If that's the deal.
Bob Clappish, I don't know if you and Bob have ever played a pass or not, but Bob has a pretty nasty fastball for a reporter. So, you know, it's possible that you might have the ability to do it.
There's a few. Tom Bertucci's a great athlete. Remember, he tried out for the Blue Jays in the spring training once for a story. I played a lot of wiffle ball in my day. I've thrown out the first pitch and I haven't bounced one yet. I can do that, but nobody would pay to watch it. But we're going to, again, like, we're going to assume that I'm not pathetic. And so if that's the case, and you give me this choice, I want to go back in time, ride the time machine, and face somebody great. So, like, I never saw Babe Ruth hit, never saw him play, never saw him do anything. So I would love to go back in time and pitch to Babe Ruth. Like, I know the ball's going to end up going 900 feet. I don't even care. Like, maybe I could fool him, and if I don't, and he hits one over the wall and all the houses across the street, I can say, whoa, I was part of that. You know, so why not? Ben, bring it on, man.
It's a great answer. And, you know, Babe Ruth, if your spirit is somewhere up there listening to this right now, come to the Field of Dreams. We'll make the Field of Dreams real instead of just a movie. Not the field. The field obviously is real, but we'll make the concept real. And you can get that chance right then and there, Jason. That's unfortunately all the time we have for you right now, Jay, but we look forward so much to chatting with you in the future. Best to you and your family, and thank you for joining us here today on Outside the Studio.
I enjoyed it, Matt. Thanks for having me, Dan.
You're welcome.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was The Athletic's Jason Stark. As you can see, we had some fun with him towards the end. You know, Babe Ruth, if you're up there, the invitation's open to come down to the Field of Dreams field and see if this can indeed happen or not. While we wait for a seance to get Ruth's answer on that, we're going to wrap up the show with this little announcement that fans, I know some of you aren't really in love with the All-Star format in the NHL, but it's definitely worth tuning in tonight on ESPN. I believe the festivities start at 7:30 Eastern time. The All-Star Skills Competition is back, and it's emanating from Las Vegas. The NHL is taking advantage fully of this opportunity. They're involving everything that they can imagine. Not only will the players be on the ice doing the breakaway challenge, which is making a return after a couple of years, not only are they doing the hardest shot competition, which, by the way, Islanders defenseman Adam Pellick is in, Chris Kreider of the New York Rangers is in the fastest skater competition, but they're also going to the Bellagio Hotel, where the world-famous fountain outside the Bellagio is going to be home to NHL players having to face off there and shoot pucks into the fountain from various angles. And it's a brand new thing that the NHL is trying to do. They're going to have the players out on the Vegas Strip doing a number of different challenges, including, instead of just a standard accuracy shooting contest, the players, keeping with the theme of Las Vegas, are going to have to shoot the pucks at playing cards, and they're going to have to try to do it to equal 21 like the game of blackjack. Can you imagine for a second the players shooting at these oversized playing cards, trying to add up their numbers in order to try to get to 21 to hit blackjack? Whether they are successful or not, it's going to make for a great visual and make for an absolutely incredible experience for the fans in attendance, for the players there in attendance. And for the fans watching back home, I highly, highly encourage you to go ahead and check it out. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, that is all the time we have for you here today. So make sure that you check out the NHL's All-Star Skills Competition tonight and the All-Star Game tomorrow. If you missed our live show, you can catch the recording on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, Spotify, Podomatic, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Player FM, iTunes and Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. So please tune back in next Friday, February 11th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for more Hot and Cold Takes. Once again, this is your host, Matthew Blittner, saying thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed our theme song written by Jessica Page Tamari, please visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full works. And we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio. Friday, February 4th,